where, by the late king's command, it was buried. So ends the story of Herod. Chapter 6. The Rise and Fall of Archelaus. Archelaus was involved in fresh disturbances by the necessity of visiting Rome. He had spent a week mourning his father and had provided the funeral feast for the populace on the most lavish scale, a custom which is the ruin of many Jews. They are obliged to feed the populace to escape the charge of impiety. Now he changed into white garments and proceeded to the temple, where the people received him with varied acclamations. In reply, he waved to the crowd from a golden throne on a raised platform and thanked them heartily for the great pains they had taken with his father's funeral, and the respect they had already shown to himself as if he was already established as king. However, for the present he was not going to assume the royal power or even the title until his succession was confirmed by Caesar, who, by the terms of Herod's will, was in supreme control. At Jericho also, when the army had tried to set the crown on his head, he had refused it. However, for their enthusiastic loyalty, he would render full payment to soldiers and people alike, as soon as the powers that were had established him as king. He would endeavor in every way to show himself kinder to them than did his father. This promise delighted the crowd, who at once tested his sincerity by making large demands. Some clamored for a lightening of direct taxation, some for the abolition of purchase tax, others for the release of prisoners. He promptly said yes to every demand in his anxiety to appease the mob. Then he offered sacrifices and sat down to a banquet with his gentlemen. But in the afternoon a number of men with revolutionary ideas collected, and began lamentations of their own when the public mourning for the late king was over, bewailing those who had been executed by Herod for cutting down the golden eagle from the temple gate. These were not secret lamentations, but piercing wails, weeping in chorus, and beating of breasts that resounded throughout the whole city, as they were for men who, they said, had died for the laws of their country and for the temple. To avenge them, they clamored for the punishment of Herod's placemen, and above all, the removal of the man he had appointed high priest, for it was their duty to choose a man of greater piety and with cleaner hands. This infuriated Archelaus, but he held his hand in view of his anxiety to begin his journey, fearing that if he aroused the hostility of the populace, the consequent disturbance might delay his departure. He therefore tried to quieten the rebels by persuasion rather than by force, and privately sent his commander-in-chief to ask them to desist. The officer came to them in the temple, but before he could utter a word, the rioters stoned him and drove him away, doing the same to many others whom Archelaus sent off to him to secure quiet. To every appeal they made a furious response, and it was evident that if they received general support, there would be no holding them. To make things worse, the Feast of Unleavened Bread was approaching, known to the Jews as the Passover, and celebrated with sacrifices on a vast scale, and there was a huge influx from the country for the festival. Meanwhile, those who were bewailing the dead rabbis massed in the temple and so provided fuel for sedition. This frightened Archelaus, who, to prevent the disease infecting the whole population, sent a tribune with his cohort to restrain by force the leaders of the sedition. Their approach infuriated the huge mob, who pelted the cohort with stones and killed most of the men, wounding the tribune, who barely escaped with his life. Then, as if nothing strange had occurred, they turned to sacrifice. Archelaus realized that the crowd could no longer be restrained without bloodshed, so he sent his whole army against them, the infantry in a body through the city, the cavalry through the fields. As all the men were sacrificing, the soldiers suddenly swooped on them, killing about 3,000, and scattered the remainder among the neighboring hills. Archelaus's heralds then followed, ordering everyone to go home. And home they all went, abandoning the feast. Archelaus, with his mother and three gentlemen, Poplas, Ptolemy, and Nicolaus, went down to the sea, leaving Philip as governor of the palace and custodian of his property. He was accompanied by Salome and her children, and by the late king's nephews and sons-in-law, who professed the intention of supporting his claim to the throne, but whose real purpose was to denounce him for his lawless actions in the temple. At Caesarea they were met by Sabinus, the procurator of Syria, who was on his way to Judea to take charge of Herod's estate, but was prevented from going further by the arrival of Varus, whom Ptolemy, on Archelaus's behalf, had begged to come. So, for the time being, Sabinus, in deference to Varus's wishes, neither hastened to the citadels nor locked Archelaus out of his father's treasuries, but promised to postpone any action until Caesar had reached a decision, and remained at Caesarea. But as soon as restraint was removed by the return of Varus to Antioch and the departure of Archelaus for Rome, he promptly set out for Jerusalem, where he took possession of the palace and, sending for the garrison commanders and comptrollers, tried to sort out the property accounts and to take possession of the citadels. However, the officers were loyal to Archelaus's instructions and continued to guard everything in the name of Caesar rather than of Archelaus. Meanwhile, Antipas also was strenuously laying claim to the kingdom, insisting that Herod's earlier will, not the later one, was valid, and that this named him king. He had a promise of support from Salome and many of the relatives who were sailing with Archelaus. He tried also to win over his mother and Nicolaus's brother Ptolemy, who seemed a weighty supporter in view of the trust Herod had reposed in him, for he had been the most honored of Herod's gentlemen. But he placed most confidence in the extraordinary skill of Irenaeus, the orator. He therefore disregarded those who advised him to give way to Archelaus as the elder brother, named in the later will. In Rome, all the relatives who detested Archelaus transferred their allegiance to Antipas. Their first preference was for autonomy under the protection of a Roman official. Failing that, they were prepared to accept Antipas as king. In these endeavors, they were aided by Sabinus, who sent letters denouncing Archelaus to Caesar and lavishing praise on Antipas. Salome and her friends collected all the charges and put the phial in Caesar's hands. Then Archelaus, in his turn, sent Ptolemy with a written summary of his own claims, his father's ring, and the official records. Caesar, having considered in private the rival dossiers, the size of the kingdom, the value of the revenue, and also the number of Herod's children, read the dispatches from Varus and Sabinus about the matter. Then he called a meeting of the Roman magistrates, giving a seat for the first time to Gaius, son of Agrippa, and his own daughter Julia, and adopted by him, and invited the disputants to put their case. Salome's son Antipater at once rose. The cleverest speaker among Archelaus's opponents, he pointed out that, though professedly Archelaus was only laying claim to the throne, actually he had been reigning for a long time, so that it was mockery now to seek an audience of Caesar, whose decision on the succession he had anticipated. As soon as Herod was dead, he had secretly bribed certain persons to crown him, He had sat in state on the throne and given audience as a king. He had altered the organization of the army and granted promotions. Furthermore, he had conceded to the people everything for which they had petitioned him as king, and had released men whom his father had imprisoned for shocking crimes. And now he had come to ask his master for the shadow of that kingship of which he had himself snatched the substance, allowing Caesar control not of realities, but of names. Antipater also alleged that his mourning for his father was a sham, that in the daytime he assumed an expression of grief, and at night indulged in drunken orgies, which by arousing man's indignation had caused the popular unrest. The speaker directed the whole force of his argument to the number of persons killed around the sanctuary, who had come to the feast only to be brutally murdered alongside their own sacrifices. Such a huge pile of corpses in the temple courts as one would scarcely have expected to see if a foreign invader had descended upon them without warning. Recognizing this vein of cruelty in his son, Herod had never given him the least hope of succeeding to the throne till his mind became more decayed than his body, and he was incapable of logical thought, and did not realize what sort of man he was making his heir by his new will, though he had no fault to find with the heir named in the earlier one, written when his health was good and his mind quite unimpaired. If, however, anyone was inclined to attach more weight to the decision made when his health was failing, the answer was that Archelaus had proved himself unfit to rule by his illegalities. What would he be like after receiving authority from Caesar when he had put so many to death before receiving it? After continuing in this vein at considerable length and bringing forward most of the relatives to witness the truth of each accusation, Antipater sat down. Then Nicolaus rose to defend Archelaus and argued that the slaughter in the temple was unavoidable, for the killed had been enemies not only of the crown, but of Caesar, who was now awarding it. The other measures with which he was charged had been taken on the advice of the accusers themselves. As for the later will, he claimed that it was valid for this reason especially, that in it Caesar was appointed executor, a man sensible enough to put the management of his affairs into the hands of the supreme ruler was not likely to choose the wrong man for his heir, and one who knew the authority that made the appointment was likely to show good sense in choosing the person to be appointed. When Nicolaus, too, had had his say, Archelaus came forward and fell down at Caesar's knees without saying a word. The emperor raised him up in the most gracious manner and declared that he deserved to succeed his father, but made no definite announcement. After dismissing those who had been his assessors that day, he thought over in private what he had been told, considering whether to appoint one of those named in the wills to succeed Herod, or to divide the power among the whole family, for it seemed necessary to provide support for the mass of interested persons. Before Caesar could reach a decision, Archelaus's mother, Marthasse, died of an illness, and letters arrived from Varus in Syria about the revolt in Judea. He had seen this coming, and so when Archelaus had sailed, he had gone to Jerusalem to restrain the prime movers. It was obvious that the populace would not remain quiet. Then, leaving in the city one of the three legions he had brought from Syria, he returned to Antioch. However, as soon as he had gone, Sabinus arrived and promptly gave the people an excuse for sedition. He tried to compel the garrison to hand over the forts and made a ruthless search for the king's money, employing not only the soldiers left by Varus, but a gang of his own slaves, arming them all and using them as instruments of his avarice. On the eve of Pentecost, a Jewish feast which takes place after 7 weeks, Pentecost means 50th day, the people assembled, not to conduct the usual rites, but to vent their wrath. An enormous crowd gathered from Galilee and Idumea, from Jericho and Perea, east of Jordan. but they could not equal in number and enthusiasm the swarm of natives from Judea itself. The whole mass split up into three divisions, which established themselves in separate camps, one to the north of the temple, one to the south by the hippodrome, and the third near the palace to the west. Thus they surrounded the Romans and began to blockade them. Their numbers and determination alarmed Sabinus, who sent a stream of messengers to Varus to request immediate assistance. If it was delayed, the legion would be cut to pieces. He himself went up to the highest tower of the fortress, the one called Basile, after Herod's brother who had died at the hands of the Parthians. From there he signaled to the legionaries to attack the enemy, for he was too panic-stricken even to go down to his own men. Doing as they were told, the soldiers dashed into the temple and engaged in a fierce combat with the Jews, in which, as long as no one shot at them from above, their experience of war gave them the advantage. But when many of the Jews climbed on to the top of the colonnades and threw their missiles onto their heads, casualties were heavy, and it was difficult either to reply to this attack from above or to resist those who fought them hand to hand. Hard-pressed from both directions, they set fire to the colonnades, works remarkable for both size and magnificence. The men on top were suddenly hemmed in by the flames. Many of them were burnt to death. Many others jumped down among the enemy and were destroyed by them. Some turned about and flung themselves from the wall. A few, seeing no way of escape, fell on their own swords and cheated the flames. A number who crept down from the walls and rushed in among the Romans were easily overpowered in their confused state. As the survivors fled in terror, the soldiers swooped on the unguarded treasury of God and carried off about 400 talents. What they did not steal, Sabinus collected. The effect on the Jews of this loss of life and property was to bring together a far bigger and better equipped force to oppose the Romans. They surrounded the palace and threatened to destroy all its occupants unless they withdrew forthwith, but promised safe conduct to Sabinus if he was prepared to take his legion away. They were reinforced by the bulk of the royal troops, who deserted to them. But the most warlike section, 3,000 men from Sebaste, with their officers, Rufus and Gratus, attached themselves to the Romans. Gratus commanded the royal infantry, Rufus the cavalry. Each of them, even without the man under him, was brave and intelligent enough to turn the scales in war. The Jews conducted a vigorous siege, assaulting the walls of the fortress and at the same time vociferously urging Sabinus and his soldiers to withdraw, and not to hinder the Jews, now that at long last they were recovering their traditional independence. Sabinus would have been only too glad to withdraw quietly, but he distrusted their promises and suspected that their soft words were a bait to catch him. As he was also expecting Varus's reinforcements, he continued to hold out. Meanwhile, in the country districts also, there were widespread disturbances, and many seized the opportunity to claim the throne. In Idumea, 2,000 of Herod's veterans reassembled with their arms and proceeded to fight the royal troops. They were opposed by Achiab, a cousin of the late king. He sheltered behind the strongest fortifications and would not risk a battle in the open. At Sepphoris in Galilee, Judas, son of Hezekiah, a robber chief who once overran the country and was suppressed by King Herod, collected a considerable force, broke into the royal armory, equipped his followers, and attacked the other seekers after power. In Perea, Simon, one of the royal slaves, considered that his good looks and great stature entitled him to set a crown on his own head. Then he went round with a band of robbers and burnt down the palace at Jericho and many magnificent country residences, securing easy plunder for himself out of the flames. He would indeed have reduced every notable building to ashes had not Gratus, commander of the royal infantry, taken the archers from Trachonitis and the best troops from Sebaste and gone to meet the adventurer. The Parians suffered heavy losses in the battle. Simon himself fled up a ravine, but was cut off by Gratus, and as he fled, a blow from the side broke his neck. The palace at Betharamatha, near the Jordan, was burnt down by another gang from Paria. A third claimant to the throne was a shepherd called Othrongius, whose hopes were based on his physical strength and contempt of death, and on the support of four brothers like himself. Each of these he put in charge of an armed band, employing them as generals and satraps on his raids, and reserving to himself as king the settlement of major problems. He set a crown on his own head, but continued for a considerable time to raid the country with his brothers. Their principal purpose was to kill Romans and the royal troops. But not even a Jew could escape if he fell into their hands with anything valuable on him. Once they ventured to surround an entire century of Romans near Emmaus when they were conveying food and munitions to their legion. Hurling their spears, they killed the centurion Arius and 40 of his best men. The rest were in danger of meeting the same fate until the arrival of Gratus with the men of Sebaste enabled them to escape. Such was the treatment that throughout the war they meted out to natives and foreigners alike. But after a while, three of them were defeated, the eldest by Archelaus, the next two in an encounter with Gratus and Ptolemy. The fourth submitted to Archelaus on terms. It was, of course, later that their career came thus to an end. At the time we are describing, they were harassing all Judea with their brigandage. When Varus received the dispatches of Sabinus and the officers, he was naturally afraid for the whole legion and hurried to the rescue. He picked up the other two legions and the four troops of horse attached to them and marched to Ptolemais, giving instructions that the auxiliaries provided by kings and local potentates should meet him there. In addition, he collected 1,500 heavy infantry as he passed through the city of Beirut. At Ptolemais, he was joined by a great number of allies. Prominent among these was Aretas, the Arab, who, because he had hated Herod, brought a considerable force of infantry and cavalry. Varus at once dispatched a portion of his army to the port of Galilee near Ptolemais, under the command of his friend Gaius. Gaius routed those who blocked his way, captured the city of Sepphoris, and burnt it, enslaving the inhabitants. With the rest of his forces, Varus himself marched into Samaria, but kept his hands off the city as he learnt that when the whole country was in a ferment, there had been complete quiet here. He encamped near a village called Arus, which belonged to Ptolemy, and for that reason was plundered by the Arabs, who were angry with Herod and his friends too. From there he went on to Sepho, another fortified village, which they plundered in the same way, seizing all the revenues they found there. Fire and bloodshed were on every side, and nothing could check the depredations of the Arabs. Emmaus, too, abandoned by its inhabitants, was destroyed by fire at the command of Varus to avenge Arius and those who had perished with him. Then he marched on to Jerusalem, where, at the first sight of him and his forces, the Jewish armies melted away, the fugitives disappearing into the countryside. The citizens, however, welcomed Varus and disclaimed all responsibility for the revolt, declaring that they had not lifted a finger, but had been forced by the occurrence of the feast to receive the swarm of visitors, so that, far from joining in the attack, they had, like the Romans, been besieged. Before this he had been met by Joseph, the cousin of Archelaus, by Rufus and Gratus at the head of the man from Sebaste, as well as the royal army, and by the members of the Roman legion with the normal arms and equipment. For Sabinus, not daring to come into Varus's sight, had already left the city for the sea. Varus sent portions of his army about the countryside in pursuit of those responsible for the upheaval, and great numbers were brought in. Those who seemed to have taken a less active part he kept in custody, while the ringleaders were crucified. About 2,000. Information reached him that in Idumea there still remained a concentration of 10,000 men, heavily armed, but he found that the Arabs were not behaving as allies, but campaigning in accordance with their own ideas, and ravaging the countryside, contrary to his wishes, through their hatred of Herod. So he sent them away, and, with his own legions, hurried to meet the rebels. They, before a blow was struck, took the advice of Achiab, and gave themselves up. Varus acquitted the rank and file of any responsibility, but sent the leaders to Caesar to be examined. Caesar pardoned most of them, but some of the king's relatives, a few of the prisoners being connected with Herod by birth, he sentenced to death for having fought against a king of their own blood. Varus, having thus settled matters in Jerusalem, left as garrison the same legion as before, and returned to Antioch. At Rome, Archelaus was involved in a new dispute with the Jews, who before the revolt had been permitted by Varus to come as ambassadors and plead for racial autonomy. These numbered 50 and were backed by more than 8,000 of the Jews at Rome. Caesar summoned a meeting of the Roman magistrates and his own friends in the Temple of Apollo, which he himself had built on the Palatine and decorated regardless of expense. The Jewish mob stood with the ambassadors facing Archelaus and his friends. His relatives' friends stood apart from them, for hatred and envy made them unwilling to be associated with Archelaus, while they did not wish Caesar to see them with his accusers. They had also the support of Philip, the brother of Archelaus, who had been sent by the kindness of Varus for two purposes. He was to cooperate with Archelaus, and if Caesar divided Herod's estate among all his descendants, he was to secure a share of it. When the accusers were called upon, they first went through Herod's crimes, declaring that it was not to a king that they had submitted, but to the most savage tyrant that had ever lived. Vast numbers had been executed by him, and the survivors had suffered so horribly that they envied the dead. He had tortured not only individual subjects, but whole cities, for he had pillaged his own to adorn those of other races, and had shed Jewish blood to gratify foreigners, depriving them of their old prosperity and their ancestral laws. He had reduced his people to poverty and utter lawlessness. In fact, the Jews had endured more calamities at Herod's hands in a few years than their ancestors had endured in all the time since they left Babylon in the reign of Xerxes and returned home. But they had become so subservient and inured to misery that they had submitted without a struggle to the continuance of their appalling slavery under Herod's successor. Archelaus, the son of that cruel tyrant, they readily acclaimed as king on the death of his father. They joined with him in mourning for Herod's death and in praying for the success of his own reign. He, as though anxious to prove himself the true son of his father, inaugurated his reign by putting 3,000 citizens to death, offering to God that number of sacrifices for his enthronement, and filling the temple with that number of dead bodies during a feast. Those who survived such a succession of calamities had naturally reflected now on their sufferings, and chosen like soldiers to receive their blows in front. They begged the Romans to pity the remnant of the Jews, and not to throw what was left of them to the savage beasts who would tear them to pieces, but unite their country with Syria and administer it through their own officials. This would show that men now falsely accused of sedition and aggression knew how to submit to reasonable authority. With this request, the Jews brought their accusation to an end. Nicolaus then rose and refuted the charges brought against the kings, accusing the populace of anarchic tendencies and habitual disloyalty to their kings. Lastly, he abused those of Archelaus's relatives who had gone over to the accusers. After hearing both sides, Caesar adjourned the meeting. But a few days later, he gave half the kingdom to Archelaus with the title of Ethnarch, and the promise that he should be king if he showed that he deserved it. The other half he divided into two tetrarchies, which he bestowed on two other sons of Herod, one on Philip, the other on Antipas, who was disputing the kingship with Archelaus. Under Antipas were placed Perea and Galilee, with a revenue of 200 talents, while Bataneia, Trachonitis, Aronitis, and some parts of Zeno's domain round Inano, with a revenue of 100 talents, were put under Philip. Archelaus's ethnarchy comprised Idumea, all Judea and Samaria, Samaria being excused a quarter of its taxes as a reward for not joining in the revolt. The cities placed under his rule were Strato's Tower, Sebaste, Joppa, and Jerusalem. The Greek cities of Gaza, Gadara, and Hippos were detached from the kingdom and added to Syria. The revenue from the territory assigned to Archelaus amounted to 400 talents. Salome, in addition to what the king had left her in his will, was appointed mistress of Jamnia, Azotus, and Phasilis, and as a gift from Caesar she received the palace at Ascalon. From all these she collected a revenue of 60 talents, but her domain came under the general control of Archelaus. Each of Herod's other descendants received what had been left to him in the will. On the two unmarried daughters, Caesar bestowed, in addition, 500,000 silver drachmas, and arranged that they should marry the sons of Pheroras. After dividing up Herod's estate, he also shared out among them all the legacy bequeathed to him by Herod, the sum of 1,000 talents, after picking out a few treasures of no intrinsic value in memory of the departed. At this period, a young man, Jewish by birth, but brought up at Sidon by a Roman freedman, took advantage of his physical resemblance to pass himself off as Alexander, whom Herod had executed, and thinking himself safe from detection, came to Rome. Assisting him was a fellow countryman who knew all that went on in royal circles, and who instructed him to say that the man detailed to execute him and Aristobulus had been moved by pity to smuggle them away, leaving instead bodies resembling theirs. With this pretense, he deceived the Jews in Crete, who provided him with the means to travel in luxury to Milos. There, by his amazing plausibility, he collected a much greater sum and induced his backers to sail with him to Rome. Landing at Puteoli, he obtained very large contributions from the Jews there and was escorted on his way like a king by his father's friends. So convincing was the physical likeness that men who had seen Alexander and remembered him well swore it was he. The whole Jewish community in Rome poured out to see him, and an enormous crowd gathered in the narrow streets through which he was carried. For so completely had the Melians lost their wits that they carried him in a litter and furnished him with royal splendor at their own expense. Caesar, acquainted with Alexander's features since he was accused by Herod before him, realized even before seeing the man that it was a case of impersonation. But on the chance that there was something behind these sanguine hopes, he sent one Celadus, who remembered Alexander well, with orders to bring the young man to him. As soon as Celadus set eyes on him, he observed the differences in his face, and noticing that his whole body was tougher and more like a slave's, he saw through the whole plot, and was most indignant at the impudence of the fellow's story, for when asked about Aristobulus, he insisted that he too was alive, but had been left in Cyprus on purpose for fear of treachery. They were safer apart. Celadus took him aside and said, Caesar will spare your life in return for the name of the man who persuaded you to tell such monstrous lies." The youth replied that he would give him the required information, and accompanied him into Caesar's presence, where he pointed to the Jew who had made use of his likeness to Alexander for profit. He himself had received more gifts in every city than Alexander received in his whole lifetime. Caesar was highly amused, and in view of his splendid physique, sent the pseudo-Alexander to join his galley-slaves, but ordered the man who led him astray to be put to death. The Melians were sufficiently punished for their folly by the loss of their money. At that time, a man was going about Judea, remarkably dressed. He wore animal hair on those parts of his body not covered by his own. His face was like a savage's. He called on the Jews to claim their freedom, crying, "God sent me to show you the way of the law, so that you can shake off any human yoke. No man shall rule you, but only the Most High who sent me." His message was eagerly welcomed, and he was followed by all Judea and the district round Jerusalem. All he did was to baptize them in the Jordan and dismiss them with an earnest exhortation to abandon their evil ways. If they did so, they would be given a king who would liberate them and master the unruly, while himself acknowledging no master. This promise was derided by some, but believed by others. The man was brought before Archelaus and an assemblage of lawyers, who asked who he was and where he had been. He replied, "I am a man called by the Spirit of God, and I live on stems, roots, and fruit." When he was threatened with torture if he did not stop behaving and talking like this, he retorted, "It would be more to the point if you stopped acting so disgracefully and submitted to the God you profess to worship." Simon, a scribe of Essene origin, sprang up and exclaimed angrily, "We study Holy Writ every day. You have just come out of the forest like a wild animal, and do you dare put us right and mislead the people with your damnable nonsense?" Simon then rushed at him to tear him to pieces, but the man replied with a warning, "I will not reveal to you the secret that is in your midst, as you have refused to listen, and so have brought immeasurable disaster upon your own heads." Then off he went to the other side of Jordan, where he resumed his work, unmolested. Established as ethnarch, Archelaus, unable to forget the old quarrels, treated not only Jews, but even Samaritans, so brutally that both peoples sent embassies to accuse him before Caesar, with the result that in the 9th year of his rule he was banished to Vienne in Gaul, and his property transferred to Caesar's treasury. Before he was summoned by Caesar, so we are told, he dreamt that he saw 9 large full ears of corn devoured by oxen. He sent for the seers and some of the Chaldeans and asked what they thought this foretold. Various interpretations were given, Simon, one of the Essenes, suggesting that the ears denoted years, and the oxen a political upheaval, because by ploughing they overturned the soil. Archelaus would rule 1 year for every ear, and would pass through various political upheavals before he died. 5 days after hearing this, the dreamer was called to his trial. I think I might also mention the dream of his wife, Glaphyra, daughter of Archelaus, king of Cappadocia. She had first married Alexander, the brother of Archelaus, about whom I have been writing, and son of King Herod, who put him to death, as already explained. When he died, she married Juba, king of Libya, and when he too died, she returned home and lived as a widow in her father's house until the ethnarch Archelaus saw her, and fell so deeply in love with her that he instantly divorced his wife Mariamne and married her. Shortly after her arrival in Judea, she dreamt that Alexander stood over her and said, "Your Libyan marriage was quite enough, but you were not satisfied with it. You came back again to my home after choosing a third husband, and, you impudent woman, my own brother at that. I shall not overlook the insult. I will fetch you back to me when